and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump uninviting the Super Bowl winners, the Philadelphia Eagles, to a White House celebration today to get ahead of the fact that few of the team were going to show up. Ben Carrington, a professor of sociology at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at USC and author of Race, Sport, and Politics, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, You Can't Separate Sports from Politics Because Sports Are Politics, and how Trump has set himself up as the arbiter of patriotism, where he alone decides who is patriotic enough to be invited to the White House. We'll examine how patriotism and sports have been fused in the rituals of playing the national anthem and having military honor guards open NFL games as military jets fly overhead. With Trump using every opportunity to insert himself into patriotic events, such as he did on Memorial Day, when he tweeted out that those who died fighting for our country would be happy with the Trump economy, we'll assess whether erroneously tarring the Eagles with not standing for the national anthem, American sports fans will fall for Trump's cynical ploy, which Samuel Johnson wrote about in 1775, warning that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. Then we'll speak with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals and the university professor of sociology at Georgetown University, whose latest book just out is What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversations About Race in America. He joins us on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of RFK to discuss what white America can learn from the black experience, just as Robert Kennedy learned after meeting with James Baldwin and other black activists in 1963, and how we can all fight back as Trump tries to turn the clock back on race relations and divide America with dog whistle appeals, reviving racist hatred to rile up his base. Then finally, we will speak with Lewis Michael Seidman, professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University School of Law, who served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He joins us to discuss the latest twists and turns as Trump tries to discredit, slow, and stop the Mueller inquiry, with Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort now facing jail for witness tampering. We'll assess whether the truth will win and justice prevail in the end as Trump desperately fights his rearguard offensive against both the truth and the law. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, You Can't Separate Sports from Politics Because Sports Are Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi, it's great to join you.
Well, thank you, Ben. And of course, today President Trump made it clear that he's injecting himself into sports in a political way. He tweeted out today, "We will proudly be playing the national anthem and other wonderful music celebrating our country today at 3 p.m. The White House and the United States Marine Band and the United States Army Chorus honoring America. NFL, no escaping to locker rooms." And of course, he's referring to the fact that the Super Bowl winners, the Philadelphia Eagles, most of their players weren't going to show up. So Trump rather petulantly canceled the event, but now going to put on this alternative event. It seems as if what Donald Trump is really doing here is he's essentially saying, I'm the arbiter of patriotism.
Yeah, and he's been doing that for a while. I mean, Trump never misses an opportunity to insert himself into these discussions. And he does it strategically. And I think in some ways we need to get away from this idea that kind of when Trump talks about sports, it's a diversion from politics, because it is politics. It's quite clear now that this is a strategy that he's using quite deliberately because he feels it will be effective for him and the Republicans in the midterm elections. And if we go back to that moment last year, and I think we've spoken about this before, in Huntsville, Alabama, when he was given the campaign speech, and that's when he made his kind of infamous remarks about the protesting NFL players as being sons of bitches, you know, and urge the owners to fire the players. If you remember, at that moment, the crowd chants out USA, USA, USA spontaneously. And Trump kind of just revels in this kind of adulation, this kind of very this kind of feverish nationalistic atmosphere. And he knows that by attacking the NFL, by attacking the NFL, the players have protested in the NFL, and particularly black athletes, that he can tap into a very kind of visceral level a certain type of like white anxiety about the nature of American society and the place of black athletes. And so he uses it very strategically. You know, he has no interest in, you know, respecting the flag or supporting the troops. And he himself, you know, did whatever he could to avoid being enlisted into the army. So, you know, so as someone who himself, you know, did whatever was possible not to engage, you know, himself with being enlisted into the military. There's no evidence in his career that he's ever had any real desire to respect or to support the troops or to be concerned about, you know, military veterans, other than symbolically. And so for him, this is the perfect issue in which he can pretend it's about American freedom and American liberties and supporting the troops. But the effect is that politically it helps to mobilize a certain segment of his white base who do have these anxieties. And so he's become, if you like, their kind of spokesperson. And he amplifies these issues at every single opportunity.
So rather than face up to the fact that he's unpopular with African Americans, he's basically going to be able to turn this event around by suggesting that the Eagles players are not patriotic, and he's tarring them with the idea that they disrespect the flag and the national anthem. And essentially what he's saying, if you don't meet my standard of patriotism, you don't get to come to my house. Well, of course, the White House is the people's house, but Trump appears to be treating it as it's the Trump Organization's latest acquisition.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And in many ways, I think this is where, you know, some of the discussions about the fascist, you know, the kind of fascist elements of Trump politics kind of hold true. And, you know, we should be careful about invoking fascism because of, you know, the terrible history, especially in Europe and Central and South America, of fascism, and sometimes it's done a bit too easily. But one of the key tenets of fascism is the extent to which the leader becomes synonymous with the nation and the military and the state, and they become indivisible. You know, we see this, you know, from Mussolini to Stalin, you know, through to Hitler, of course, and to Franco, and you see this over and over again with Trump, that he quite deliberately, strategically, and I think has come to believe it, that he is the nation, that in other words, that to disrespect Donald Trump is to disrespect the nation. Because when you look at his press releases, it's hard to disentangle, in terms of how Trump understands the issue, the disrespect that he personally feels, because he feared, basically, that, you know, and this is what was going to happen as well. And I've just been watching a number of the Trump supporters on the TV networks defending him by saying that and parroting what was also said by the press secretary earlier today, that the Philadelphia Eagles refused to turn up. That's not true. Trump disinvited them once it became apparent that so few players would be going. So in order to protect Trump's ego, he turns that into a disrespect to the nation, to the flag, to the military. And he does this time and time again. And therefore, presumably, to be patriotic, to support the military, to support the troops, you therefore, ergo, have to support Donald Trump, preferably in the elections in November. So it's a great and clever move strategically from a political point of view. Morally, of course, it's abhorrent, and I think that the Democrats and other leftists really need to think through how they're going to try to cleverly disentangle Trump's invocation of American patriotism in a way in which he is clearly doing.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington. And again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor in the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, You Can't Separate Sports from Politics Because Sports Are Politics. But when you talk about the dictators also injecting themselves into sports, and I think it was 1934 that the German team, when the Nazis were in control of Germany, played France, a soccer match in France, and the team, during the national anthem of Deutschen Über Alles, they did not do the Hitler salute. And Hitler was furious with them and suspended them. So, I mean, it seems a little bit like a coincidence. Again, you know, I'm not saying Trump is automatically a fascist, even if he has clear and present fascist tendencies, but still does strike me as somewhat ironic.
Yeah, and there's also the narcissism of small men who like the power and the grandeur that the state apparatus provides for them. I mean, and again, this is the... You know, without going too far into the psychology of fascist leaders, you just do see that in Trump. I mean, it's unfortunate. He looks like El Duce at times when he does that kind of, when he gets the adulation, he just kind of steps back and just basks in the glory. But anyway, just to kind of come back against the NFL, I think this also shows the ludicrous and stupid attempt by the NFL last week when they adopted this new anthem policy, which effectively said that the NFL can't fine players directly, but what it said is it would consider fining teams whose players refuse to stand for the anthem and to show, quote, respect for the flag. But then it was trying to kind of thread the needle, but it said, but you know, if a player decides to stay in the locker room, that's fine. As if this would appease Trump. I mean, the only reason that policy exists is because of the political pressure Trump has asserted onto the NFL, and the NFL acquiesced to Trump's hyper-nationalist, partisan, and implicitly racist agenda. And they thought, well, this is a clever way to avoid, to kind of move beyond that. And instead, they've now helped Trump to make this front and center. So at the beginning of the first games, now this is all we're going to be talking about. Like, once again, what are the players doing in relation to kind of protests? Who's in the locker room? But like we said at the beginning, this is like those who keep saying that, you know, we need to move away from sports and get back to talking about politics truly misunderstand, one, that sports is politics. Sports is a form of politics. And also, in a sense, how clever, politically speaking, Trump is, because he gets that, you know, few other cultural arenas in American life produce the kind of passionate identifications and emotional responses as sports and the NFL in particular. A few other cultural arenas in American life kind of conflate nationalism and militarism, but also center black bodies at labor. You know, these are black workers who carry this wider symbolic weight around what it means to be American, what it means to be a man, the kind of violence inherent within the NFL. So it's really kind of fissile material, if you like, for these kind of wider discussions around race and gender and nationalism. And Trump gets that. So he's going to come back to this issue time and time and time again, regardless of his interest in the NFL and how well the NFL is doing, because it's a way to kind of mobilize his base, to present himself as a true patriot, and to present those dissenters, those black dissenters, as being unpatriotic, un-American. And even as he suggested last week, that anyone who protests, you know, should be deported, that we should even question their citizenship rights. And again, it's not just about the players. It's the way in which Trump is trying to attack the left in general. Anyone who begins to talk about questions of social injustice or police brutality, or begins to kind of, you know, seriously discuss the forms of inequality within American life, Trump is using this as a wedge to discredit all those types of leftist critiques.
Well, when you talk about Mussolini, the comparisons with the puffing the chest and the jaw jutting out, I recall that vividly when he, at Huntsville, Alabama, in that rally, the campaign rally you referenced earlier, Ben Carrington, where Trump said, would you love to see one of these NFL owners when somebody disrespects our flag? Get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. he's fired. And then the crowd, of course, chanted USA, USA, USA in response. But when he said he's fired, the look on his face was this contorted look of venality and vicious anger, which really does have echoes of a totalitarian strongman, even though, of course, we know that Trump is a weak strongman. In your article, you note that the sports journalist with The Nation, Dave Zirin, noted with the recent photo op in the White House with Sylvester Stallone, where Trump did a posthumous pardon for Jack Johnson, the heavyweight boxer. Dave Zirin notes that there is little doubt that if Trump was alive in Jack Johnson's day, he would have been one of his tormentors, not his savior. And I think you can support that charge by simply referring to Trump's attacks on the Central Park Five. He took out full-page ads against these wrongly accused young black teenagers and ran a racist campaign against them, even though, of course, it turned out they were innocent.
Absolutely. I think it's another good example of how, I mean, not just Trump. I mean, I guess one of the things we need to always make sure that we do in these discussions and with this analysis is to not fixate on Trump himself. Like, Trump is representative. Trump is the kind of figure that is articulating kind of wider sentiments. But you're right. It's interesting how someone like Trump, but American society more generally, actually does venerate iconic black athletes as long as they're dead. You know, preferably they've been dead for a while and then they can be recuperated. But it can't accommodate a living black athlete who is bold enough, who is courageous enough to speak truth about America's racial injustices in the present. And so, the example of Muhammad Ali would be a clear one. If you look at how chastised Muhammad Ali was, the extent to which he was seen to be un-American, that he was stripped of his ability to box, that he was public enemy number one during the high point, during the pinnacle of his career. And all of these eulogies that then came out when Muhammad Ali died a couple of years ago, often from the very same conservative pundits and figures who either at the time or their equivalents would have castigated Muhammad Ali and who were criticizing Colin Kaepernick in the present. So, I mean, this is one of the things about racial ideologies, is its ability to kind of subsume apparent contradictions. So in the same breath that Donald Trump at the ceremony in the White House can talk about the racial injustices that Jack Johnson suffered, you know, and the indignities that the black men have to suffer when they're being racially abused and discriminated against, as Donald Trump does exactly the same thing the next moment, an hour later, in tweets about, you know, the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, etc. So, but just highlighting those contradictions aren't enough. They're not sufficient because of the way in which Trump kind of embraces and immerses himself within the hyper-nationalism that saturates a political discourse in America. I mean, in many ways, this is the central problem, that the kind of this belief in American exceptionalism from across the political spectrum, at least the mainstream political spectrum, makes it very hard to engage in any realistic and honest discussion about the state of America, because the moment that you do so, you're labeled as being un-American and not being a true patriot. And again, this is why Trump understands that sports are really a really important vehicle, because there's so much unthinking, performed patriotism in American sports. As soon as these athletes are brave enough to kind of puncture that moment, then they are labeled as being outside of the mainstream. They are labeled as being anti-American. And it kind of like closes down the space for any kind of critical discussion around America's current failings.
Well, the Eagle safety, Malcolm Jenkins, said that he wasn't going to attend the ceremony at the White House because he didn't want to be part of a photo op and wanted to avoid being used as any kind of pawn. And I think that is the trap that Trump is setting for them, because he is, as you point out in your article at the Huffington Post, Ben Carrington, Trump never misses an opportunity to claim credit where none is due. And you look and you point to the Memorial Day ceremony at Arlington, where Trump tweeted praise for the nation's fallen, adding that those who gave their lives for America would be especially happy to learn that the economy was doing well under his administration. So I can just see all of those patriots turning over in their graves in Arlington. I mean, it's just an extraordinary usurpation of patriotism. But that's not to say that patriotism has not already been usurped. When people say you should take politics out of sports, you don't have to look any further than every big game in the NFL starts with a bunch of military jets flying over and a military guard of honor at the opening ceremony. So sports, to that extent, have been ritualized and militarized.
Absolutely. And again, this is this is one of the problems, I think, in these discussions, is that in some ways, like, Trump isn't the problem. Trump is merely exploiting a situation which was already problematic, that most people didn't recognize as problematic. Or, let me put it another way. Many Americans did not. I teach a course at the University of Southern California on sports and social change. And often it's during my class that the American students, for the first time, discover that, in fact, it's not normal to sing the national anthem before every sports event in the rest of the world. And so these are students who, you know, don't perceive themselves necessarily to be kind of right-wing or hyper-nationalistic, but it's so normalized in the U.S. around sporting cultures that the kind of the conflation and the convergence of nationalism and sports, and a particular type of nationalism that is nearly always and already militarized, that these things become so co-joined that they become normalized and part of the kind of sporting common sense in the States. And it's not normal. I mean, there's a reason why if you go, you know, go to a sports event in Germany, they're not flying World War II bombers over the stadium, you know, and the crowd aren't chanting in unison, Deutschland, Deutschland. You know, because of that the history and the recognition of what that type of nationalism leads to in terms of fascist outcomes. And that's recognized in most of the rest of the world apart from the U.S. And Trump is exploiting, in other words, a problematic relationship that people only now begin to think about, yeah, why do we sing the national anthem before a sports event? You know, why not sing it before every film, every showing of a film at a cinema? I mean, that's when I do say that to my students, like, what would you think the next time you went to the cinema and before the film was shown, everybody in the cinema had to stand up and sing the national anthem on place? They say, well, that's ridiculous. Now, why would you do that before a film or a play? Well, the question is, well, why would you do it before a sports event? What is it about a sports event in America that makes it the site for this kind of performed paid patriotism to take place that we would probably question in most other cultural spaces? So I think if we can begin to unpick and unpack those close relationships, some good may come out of this. But the problem is that kind of wider critical reflection very rarely takes place, and it certainly isn't taking place within the mainstream media discussions, which just basically comes back down to, you know, Donald Trump as an individual, and, you know, what the NFL should be doing. And that broader question is often left out of the discussion.
Well, Ben Carrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, You Can't Separate Sports from Politics Because Sports Are Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back, joined by Michael Eric Dyson, to discuss his new book just out, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversations About Race in America. Depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dude, don't let them play us. Girls, they are. He was not a violent man. If you can, just why was he shot down the other day? I'm gonna say he'd seen the mountain top. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Tears We Cannot Stop. He is the University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and a contributing editor of The New Republic and ESPN's The Undefeated. His latest book just out is What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversations About Race in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Eric Dyson.
Hello, my friend. It's great to be on your show.
Well, thank you, Michael. And just our previous segment was on Donald Trump's canceling the Philadelphia Eagles in a rather petulant way because they weren't going to show up. And he had, of course, his ego is such that he had to preemptively cancel them. But essentially what Trump is saying here is he's appointing himself as the arbiter of what patriotism is in this country. And if you don't meet my standard of patriotism, you don't get invited to my house. Of course, the White House is the people's house, but Trump is acting as though the White House is the latest real estate acquisition by the Trump Organization.
Absolutely right. I mean, it's vicious. It's the rise of a kind of neo-fascist impulse to reduce the complexity, the magnitude, the depth, and variety of patriotism to the narrow understanding that Mr. Trump himself possesses. And it's dangerous. Because when we let an official and a governmental representative define for us the exclusive property of patriotism, we are in deep trouble because this nation is informed by people who have had robust conversations and vigorous disagreement about what constitutes true patriotism. But we do know that nobody has a copyright on it or the exhaustive capacity to define it to the exclusion of other definitions, and his rejecting out of hand in advance the Philadelphia Eagles as representatives of America because of their excellence at the Super Bowl, he is undercutting a valiant and valuable tradition in America of recognizing the diversity of definitions that make up patriotism in America.
Well, of course, our president is at war with both the truth and the law. And your new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America, I want to talk to you about that, obviously. But in the broader landscape, we're in a country now where there is no consensus about what is true. I mean, it is basically the truth is we are, as Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand. But frankly, we are a house divided against ourselves in terms of the truth. You've got Trump's people in the hermetically sealed world of Fox News believing that everything is fake news except what they put out and that what the mainstream media puts out is fake news. And clearly the opposite is true. So I don't know how you bridge that gap in, and I frankly don't know how the world's lone superpower can survive with no consensus about what is real.
Yeah, you know what? This is why it's good to have black people in America. Because one of the things we do is remind people, y'all just not dealing with post-truth. We've been dealing with post-truth since 1619, when they brought 20 Africans here, extracted from their resting in their African soil, and brought here to serve the will of God. That's post-truth. That's been post-truth since the assertion that human beings who are made in the image of God are not, that they are savages. What we called, what some in America call progress, indigenous people call genocide. When people during the Civil War believed that they were fighting that war in behalf of states' rights, and we knew that it was about, in genuine terms, race in America and the ability to own human beings as slaves, we were post-truth then. So what did black people do? We persisted through the odds. We kept insisting that our truths would win out. We got on the side of what we saw was victorious, which is truth will rise again and the truth will out. And we believed that ultimately that the universe would conspire with us against those who were the vicious liars against the tradition of not only truth-telling, but of living and practicing that truth And we believed ultimately that America would identify us and accept us and acknowledge us as truthful beings, and that that truth would ultimately sway the day. And I think that we need to remind Americans who are bitterly disappointed and, in one sense, despondent about what Donald Trump represents. He ain't the worst, he ain't the first, and he won't be the last.
And he won't succeed, surely. You simply cannot turn back the clock in the ultimate sense. Okay. I mean, atavism doesn't work, does it? At least I don't think it does.
Right. So, no, absolutely not. But, it's, you know, I think the reality is that this president is seeking, through a perverted sense of nostalgia, a day in America where, you know, people of color didn't speak up, where women didn't have rights, where white people were unquestionably at the center of American culture, and those of us in the 21st century must reject and rebel against such a narrow conception of who we are as a nation.
Well, Ronald Reagan tried that back in the 80s, the idea of going back to the Aussie and Harriet Halcyon days where blacks and Latinos were invisible. It didn't work then, so I don't see it's ever going to work, even though in the short term you do have this silo of, what, 30% in Trump land listening to the dog whistles. And my sense is that Trump and, by extension, the Republicans have rediscovered dog whistle politics, and they've revived racism as a kind of desperate last hurrah against demographics. And as somebody recently said, demographics are destiny.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that those halcyon days that are now long ago, for those who believe that they existed, must listen to Stephanie Kuntz, who writes that they never were what we said they used to be, basically. That there was always nostalgia and therefore exaggeration and therefore a bit of mendacity at the heart of our retrieval, of our retrieval of the past, of our remembrances of those pasts that are now under scrutiny and that are in competition as candidates for the source of the present. In other words, there are many versions of the past that are available to us. There are many versions of what is right and wrong, and what we have to do is to oppose as much as we can the kind of lunatic nostalgia that would be that would issue forth in a kind of a neo-fascist appropriation of the past by saying, because what Donald Trump doesn't just want to own the present, he wants to own how we interpret the past, what we used to do. You got to lie about the past in order to lie about the present. So in that sense, if demographics are destiny in terms of who gets a chance to get a seat at the table and who gets a chance to narrate the story, this is why we must never surrender our capacity as agents, even if we are less powerful than those who are doing harm to us, that we have a voice and we have a story and we have a vision and we must insist upon its being told, and we can never surrender ultimately the power and authority of our witness. That's what James Baldwin did. That's what Harry Belafonte did and Lorraine Hansberry and Lena Horne, and we've got to do the same thing today.
And Michael Eric Dyson, you're referring to a 1963 meeting that took place with Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He sought out James Baldwin to explain the rage that threatened to engulf black America. And James Baldwin brought along his friends, Lorraine Hansberry, psychologist Kenneth Clark, and the activist Jerome Smith. And it was a very uncomfortable three-hour session, was it not, for Robert Kennedy?
Absolutely, sir, because Robert Kennedy thought, when he had a meeting with, you know, these leading figures, he didn't want to meet with civil rights leaders. He wanted to meet deliberately with leading figures who were not part of the civil rights movement so that they wouldn't feel that they couldn't tell the truth, that they were more beholden to their organizations than to the truth as they saw it. So he got writers and activists who were free enough and intellectuals who were free enough to bear witness to the truth as they saw it. And Robert Kennedy thought that they were going to, you know, be grateful to him for all of the things that the Kennedy administration had done. And instead, they, you know, lit him up, so to speak. They said, no, we're not going to be grateful because you're speaking out of both sides of your mouth. You are not being honest about the need for serious engagement with the issue of race. And you're not being honest about the degree to which the rage of black people exists
because of the failed policies of even a liberal administration that was trying to at once placate white supremacists and bigots on the one hand by putting Harold Cox, who was a jurist, on the bench down south, and he would call black people niggas from the very bench he presided from. And when he promised Mr. Vandiver, the governor, I think, of Georgia, that when he was elected, he would not use the federal government to impose constraints on that state, and that he would not try to use federal authority to undermine the practices of segregation. And at the same time, he's telling black civil rights leaders and black other black leaders that he would support civil rights and perhaps one day put forth legislation to quell the racial injustice there. So they knew they were dealing with a very complicated administration, and yet, despite that, they said, unless you are honest and speak up for that which is true and righteous, we are not going to agree with you. And they pushed, and finally, at a three-hour meeting, and for the most of that meeting, Bobby Kennedy, for the first time, had to listen to the black people and not lecture them.
And Michael Eric Dyson, in your new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America, in your book, and of course today is the 50th anniversary of both the, we're having a California primary here, and 50 years ago, Bobby Kennedy won the California primary and shortly thereafter was assassinated. And you write in the book, your new book, Bobby Kennedy was the first white person I believed cared for black folk, and the sorrow and grief his death evoked in black America made me realize I wasn't alone. So it's something changed, right? Obviously with Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, Bobby Kennedy changed. I mean, well, first he was pissed. First he was mad. First he was upset. First, he was rather angry. He sicked the FBI on the people who were at that meeting. He either started or continued dossiers that the FBI had collected immorally, if not illegally, on many of the members of that meeting. And then that led, ironically and bitterly enough, to the surveillance of the FBI of Martin Luther King Jr., because his lawyer and James Baldwin's lawyer, which was Clarence Jones, and Clarence Jones was at that meeting, and it eventually led to the surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. And the wiretap was authorized by Bobby Kennedy. So this was not one of his high moments or greatest days. And yet, after he simmered down and calmed down, he said, look, if I were black, I'd be full of rage as well. I would also end up thinking that if I were black, that it is, this society is not fair to me. I wouldn't necessarily want to serve my country in a war when I was not being respected at home. And it changed his mind. He took heed to their admonition that the president of the United States of America must also see race not only as a political issue, but as a moral one, and must speak out and use his bully pulpit. And that it changed his understanding of race in terms of public policies that should be pursued. And instead of being insensitive to and unempathetic with the masses of black people, he became deeply sympathetic, deeply empathetic, and began to use his own platforms to speak eloquently in behalf of the most vulnerable people in this country, including the poor and African-American people.
Well, I don't know that it's a coincidence, but J. Edgar Hoover, the two people he hated most in the world were Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And, you know, we've obviously had too much martyrdom with both of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. And it seems like martyrdom by definition is a way, or at least assassination is a way, to demoralize and defeat our hopes and aspirations. So how do we get out of that trap of expecting to lose? We've got to win.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, and we got to win because we ultimately believe we're on the winning side. That truth will win out. That justice will prevail. That righteousness will rise above the morass of mendacity and evil and, you know, indifference to justice. So in that sense, you know, my pastor used to tell me something. He said, don't fight for victory, fight from victory. know already that you have won. Know already that you're in the right lane, the right position, the right starting point, and the right conduct for the justice you want to see brought into the world. And if you side with that from the very beginning, if it governs your speech, your actions, your thoughts, your behavior, your expectation, then you won even before you see the victory come to fruition. So in that sense, we've got to have victories. We've got to have wins. We've got to have people who will prevail. And in order to do that, we've got to be pretty shrewd in our political analysis. And we've got to understand what it is that we must do in order to put ourselves in a position to win, to prevail, whether it's a race in California or one in, Georgia, whether it was the president of the United States of America, as, you know, Barack Obama was. And even though people weren't, you know, completely satisfied with him and completely, that's understandable, he did register a victory of sorts for, you know, certain varieties of progressive people and moderately progressive people. So, you know, what we've got to do is understand that this is a vicious game and that we've got to play it. We can't be perfectionists. We can't say that, you know, as in the last election. Let me give an example. Some of my black compatriots on the left said, well, there's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Could you say that now? Could you actually believe that now? Could you not believe that as bad as you thought Hillary Clinton might have performed, that she certainly wouldn't have performed as poorly as Mr. Trump is now? So in that sense, I think that we shouldn't make, as the old saying goes, the perfect the enemy of the good. And we got to figure out ways that we can leverage the moral authority and political influence we possess in behalf of the masses of people who need our representation and, to a degree, our leadership.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy.
I appreciate you, brother. You're one of the sharpest and most eloquent interviews I've had. So thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, my man.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals and the author of the New York Times bestseller Tears We Cannot Stop. And his latest book just out is What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a former law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall about the latest twists and turns as Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort now faces jail for witness tampering. Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Louis Michael Seidman, a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University, who served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Louis Michael Seidman.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And in effect, our president is at war with the truth and at war with the law. So somebody that's particularly with a history that you have, having served for one of the great lines of liberalism, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, have you ever witnessed a situation where the commander-in-chief, the head of the country, appears to be at war with the major institutions of government like the DOJ and the FBI?
Well, actually, while I was clerking for Justice Marshall, the Watergate events were unfolding. And I remember them very clearly, and I think that's the closest analogy. But there were a number of things that, first of all, I think what Trump has done is worse. But what's more troubling, there were a number of things that were in place in Watergate that really controlled Nixon and ultimately led to his downfall that are not in place today, including the fact that both the House and the Senate were in Democratic hands, and that Nixon had been forced to accept an attorney general and a special prosecutor who were devoted to making sure that the law was enforced. And then, of course, the fact that Nixon had had the poor judgment of taping his crimes. So things are much more dicey today than they were then, I think.
So can you give us any sense of hope or optimism here that in the lobby of the CIA, they have inscribed from the Gospel of St. John, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. Given that there's no agreement about what is true and that we have this peculiar situation where I think another difference between Watergate and the current situation with Special Counsel Mueller is that everything that Mueller is doing is secret and we don't know and he's being very careful not to leak anything, whereas the Watergate hearing was seen by all. It was a massive television event. So what was happening in terms of an investigation was being revealed before our eyes. Is that a situation, since we don't know what Mueller knows and that we're speculating, that that's also an advantage that Trump has?
Well, yes. I mean, and that is related to the fact that Congress is now in Republican hands. So the Watergate Committee in Congress was tremendously important, and that happened because the Senate was controlled by the Democrats. You know, in terms of optimism, I think things are still very much up in the air. It is worth remembering also that Watergate took a very long period of time, and by those standards, we're still sort of midway through this. Ultimately, this is a question that is going to be resolved by the American people. I mean, it's going to be resolved in the November election. It's going to be resolved in the reaction to the Mueller, whatever Mueller comes up with. And we don't yet know how it's going to play out. And yes, there are some reasons for optimism. I mean, Trump's approval ratings are higher than they've been recently, but it's still the case that a solid majority of the American people don't like him and don't approve of him. And we're just going to have to see. These are very, by my lights, these are very frightening times, but we don't yet know how it's going to come out.
So one of the latest shoes to drop has been the news that Paul Manafort has been in contact with witnesses, even though he's under surveillance and is under house arrest, in effect, with an ankle bracelet. I think actually he might have two ankle bracelets. And he's facing quite a lot of jail time. It looks as though, what's your sense? There are two judges involved, but it looks as though Mueller might put him in jail.
Well, Mr. Manafort is, I think it's fair to say, in a lot of trouble. He was in a lot of trouble before this. This doesn't help him. I do think, you know, there'll be a hearing on this. He's entitled to have his side of the story heard. I don't think we should rely just on the prosecutor's filings. But that said, it's something of a mystery why Paul Manafort has not yet cracked, why he is risking all of this jail time. And there are a number of possibilities. Of course, one possibility is he just doesn't know anything. I think that's kind of unlikely, but it's possible. But the more disturbing possibility is that he thinks his best shot at beating the rap is a presidential pardon. And that's not a crazy thought on his part. That may well yet be forthcoming.
Well, it's certainly pretty clear, is it not, that the president has been signaling in that direction, has he not? I mean, I can't think of any other reason for the choice of those people he's pardoned, which seem to be sort of random and grabbed out of the air. The president is not going through the officer in the DOJ that deals with pardons. And when you look at the people who've been pardoned and why they've been pardoned, there appears to be a certain pattern there, surely.
It certainly seems that way on the outside. And, of course, it's also public knowledge that the president has been curious about and gotten legal advice about his pardon authority. I think myself, I that pardoning people for the purpose of obstructing the investigation would be unconstitutional. That is just as much a violation of the Constitution as pardoning people because of their race, for example. But I don't know. I think he's banking on courts disagreeing with that. And again, it's something we're just going to have to see how it plays out and what the reaction of the American people and Congress will be when, as I think it's inevitably the case, this will come to a head and he will try to shut the thing down one way or another.
Well, specifically in Manafort's case, apparently he was using kind of PR firms as cutouts to communicate with his former deputy in the Ukraine, who is a former GRU colonel in Russian military intelligence. I mean, if Manafort's right-hand man in Ukraine was an ex-GRU colonel, that in itself should raise a flag. And, of course, you know, on top of that, we know that the GRU were behind the hack on the DNC and the hack on Hillary Clinton's campaign manager.
So the mantra that you hear over and over again is no collusion. Mueller has completely failed to come up with any evidence of collusion. How many times have you heard that? It's manifestly untrue. So Paul Manafort is a pretty good case in point. It's just a fact that the platform of the Republican Party was changed at the last minute, apparently at Manafort's behest, to soften their long-held position on Ukraine. That's pretty clearly an example of coercion. Of collusion. And by the way, you know, people who are opponents of Trump often say that Donald Trump Jr. was lying when he said the meeting was about Russian adoptions. And in some ways, that gets it exactly backwards. The problem was the meeting was partially about Russian adoptions. That is to say, what the meeting was about was trading Trump getting dirt on Hillary Clinton for changes in the Magnitsky Act, which would have, of course, changed policy about Russian adoptions. And that is collusion. That's the whole purpose of the meeting, to effect that trade.
Well, also, it's worth pointing out that the Magnitsky Act, which was put through Congress, urged on by the former biggest foreign investor in Russia, who fell afoul of Putin and had to get out of town and has been on Putin's hit list. His attorney was Magnitsky, and he was investigating the theft of state resources, in fact, tax money that Bill Browder had paid, and they stole these characters who have connections to the very same prosecutor, by the way, that was referred to in the Trump Tower meeting as Russia's prosecutor general that they were boasting about, having dirt on Hillary Clinton. These cronies of this characters were the ones that responsible for Magnitsky being beaten to death in jail, stealing $220 million, and lo and behold, the Russian judicial system went to their defense, not to Magnitsky's defense. Browder was able to get the Magnitsky Act passed, and Putin has been obsessed with undoing that. So I think you have to put that context in there, that you're really dealing with gangsterism here.
Yes. One of the problems here is that this has gotten so multifaceted and complex that it's easy to get lost in the details. And so another difficulty is that Americans just kind of get bored and glaze over. But there really are some pretty simple things that you can hang on to. And one of the simplest is that there was a meeting with the president's son, who was and other high campaign officials, the stated purpose of which was to trade off information damaging to Hillary Clinton for things that the Russian government wanted. That is collusion. It's not really all that complicated.
Well, also, the New York Times just got a 20-page document from Trump's lawyers to Mueller, and a part of that was, in effect, an admission that President Trump had dictated the response to the charges against his son vis-a-vis this Trump Tower meeting about and instructed him to say it was about adoptions, in other words, about the Magnitsky Act. And, of course, the White House at the time and since have been denying that that happened, and Hope Hicks resigned as a result of that, it would seem. So there you have, I'm assuming, since Mueller's not leaking anything, that the document that the New York Times got hold of must have come from Trump's lawyers.
I really don't know where it came from,
sure.
But the fact that Trump's lawyers themselves admitted this in the document is pretty damning, and I do wish at the daily press briefing, the press would really push a little harder about whether that is still Trump's position. That is to say, does he agree with what his people said previously, or does he agree with what his own lawyers have said? Because the two are not reconcilable.
Right. There's a commonly used word to describe that, and that is a lie. But that seems to be a word that the White House press corps don't want to embrace. And I think the Washington Post have done surveys and studies that indicate that Trump has told over 3,000 lies so far in his tenure. And it does seem that lying is becoming the first principle of his governance. So in general, you get back, don't you, to the state of the American people. If you say they're not that interested today, of course, is the midterm election primaries. It's very important out here in California to see what happens in terms of whether or not the Democrats shoot themselves in the foot or manage to get in a position to be able to knock off some of the Republican incumbents and therefore go make strides towards taking back the House. But just in the last couple of minutes, I get back to the main question, and since you are a professor of constitutional law and you've served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall and have, you know, a career in the law, are you confident that in the end truth will win out?
I don't believe that history has an inevitable direction. And so, no, I'm not confident. I think that depends on what happens in the next 6 months to a year. And one thing that does seem pretty clear to me is it's a mistake to think that the law is ultimately going to rescue us, or that the rescue will come from the Supreme Court or from some interpretation of the Constitution. I think it's a mistake to count on institutions to rescue us. The courts, the press, the bureaucracy. In the end, there is only one solution to this problem, and that is mass mobilization. That is really getting people to go out and vote, to participate, and if necessary, to be out on the streets. That's what's going to save us. And I haven't given up hope, certainly, but I think confidence would be the wrong word. I think we're just going to have to see what happens.
Well, Louis Michael Seidman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Louis Michael Seidman, who's a professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University School of Law. He served as a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.